Sometimes you feel so alone and overwhelmed, you don't know where to turn. These days, it seems like there is no end to our problems. We invite you to connect with Silent Unity, the 24-hour prayer ministry, where someone is waiting to pray with you right now. Since 1890, Silent Unity has always been there. No judgment or dogma, just someone affirming the best for you. Call 816-969-2000 today. You can also connect online at unityprayervigil.org.
Serving spiritual seekers around the world. Unity Online Radio. Welcome to World Spirituality, exploring the unity within all cultures and faith traditions with Paul John Roach, minister of Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. Discover the universal principles present in all the world's religions and take an incredible journey to new understanding. Now, here is your host, Paul John Roach.
So, hello and welcome to World Spirituality on the Unity Online Radio Network. Yes, I'm your host, Paul John Roach, coming to you from Unity Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas. My show today is part two in a two-part series where I interview the sons of the internationally famous teacher, a spiritual master and author, Don Miguel Ruiz. And last week, the delightful Don Jose Ruiz was with me, and we talked about his life story. And about his book that he wrote about that called My Good Friend, The Rattlesnakes. And we shared many insights. It was a wonderful show. And you can listen to it by pulling up the World Spirituality Archives. This week, though, I welcome Don Miguel Ruiz Jr. to the show. Don Miguel Jr. is also an author and teacher in his own right. And his books include The Five Levels of Attachment, The Mastery of Self, and a lovely book he's put together called Don Miguel Ruiz's Little Book of Wisdom, The Essential Teachings, which is in sort of bite-sized format. So it's something you can pick up and read and cogitate and contemplate for the day and then pick it up again at another time. So it's a wonderful little workbook. So it's a great pleasure to welcome Don Miguel Ruiz Jr. to today's show. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Paul. Thank you so much for having me on your program. It's a true honor. Thank you.
I like the book because it has three parts. Part one is a short description, isn't it, by your dad of his transformations, the sort of two or three things that happened to him that sort of shifted his whole focus. And then the third part is a sort of a section where you share about your apprenticeship and some of your openings and what you'd learned. And I want to talk more about that in a little bit. And then in the middle is, like I say, is these relatively short statements that come from, I think, his books, but also from some of your talks with him, right, that are lovely because they're short enough you can read them and then, like I say, meditate upon them. So it makes it a very fascinating book. Let's talk about part one, though, first of all. Your dad had an accident, didn't he? A car accident that opened him up to the fact that he wasn't just a physical being. There was a spiritual dimension. But then there's that beautiful story of the stars in the desert. You want to talk about those two experiences that he had?
Well, yeah, the stories that my father shared with us throughout our growing up with him, and his apprentices were about his awakening, you can say. My father, when he was young, it seems to be like a tradition in the family to rebel against the tradition. We try to make our own life and engage our own way of living. And my father became a medical doctor, a medical surgeon. And, his way was through science and Western medicine and things like that, logic and academia. So one day he went to a party in Cuernavaca, from what I remember, and on his way back with his driving with his friends, intoxicated a little bit, and he fell asleep on the wheel. He crashed. Now, in this thing, is that according to his stories, he remembers seeing himself leave his body. He remembers seeing him taking the people out of the car and before the crash and then just impact. So that's the stories he remembers. He remembers that experience, and he couldn't explain it. He couldn't explain what he saw, whether or not it was a figment of his imagination, a figment of him, whatever image he had, but he didn't have questions that logic would say. You know, he woke up with a nurse kind of taunting him a little bit, thinking that he had killed his friends, but he said, no, they're not dead, you all survive. But it's a moment of clarity, a wake-up call, you can say. A wake-up call that made everything he believed, well, it was put into question. So he reached out to his family, to his mom, my grandmother, Marcelita, and his grandfather, Don Leonardo, who had been teaching him up to that point, and he began that process. And the experience of the stars when he was in Sonora, after he graduated from medical school, you know, after this incident, a couple of years later, practicing with his mother, practicing with his grandfather, he was in Sonora, and he went outside the hospital, walked around the desert, and he looked up in the skies, and he became aware that he and the stars were all one. He had this epiphany, this moment of clarity, you can say, that he was a living being. A living being that was engaged in everything in life. And not just in the physical plane, you can say that in everything, you can say spiritual, that he was more than just his body, that the body that he had was just an inanimate object that one day he will leave behind with his last breath. As a doctor, he's very much aware of that. But with that experience of leaving his body, of experiencing his own mortality, he realizes that while there's life, everything is possible. And you can say that's what made him redirect his attention from what he was doing in medicine, and realizing that he was, as a doctor, he was just in a conveyor belt, dealing with symptom after symptom after symptom, and never finding the root cause of what causes all this human suffering and human burdens that we have. So he let go of the medical profession and decided to focus completely in the family tradition, which is as a shaman at first, and then he lets go of that, of course, as well. He lets go of the image of the shaman and just practices what he calls common sense. When he merges what he learned in medical school, what he learned in science, with our tradition, he cleans the tradition up from fanaticism, from a lot of the stuff that people found to be, I could say, the superstition out of it, and just kept the core elements of the teachings, of the lessons, which you could say is the Four Agreements and many of the books that we've written or he's taught throughout life. So basically, those two stories are a moment of clarity for him, that he chooses to shift the direction of his own life, to see what is beyond the limitations of his own beliefs and see what he can create. And
yes,
grateful for us is that he decided to live his own life. You know, so to me, from the point of view of a 41-year-old, that's me looking at my father, I basically see him as I see that moment as a moment in time where he asked himself, how does he want to live his life? Does he want to continue this old image that he had for himself with an old goal, or did he want to live his life the way he wants to live his life without those fears? And that's what allows him to do with what he's done since then.
Absolutely, yeah. And there's one idea that he shared that I loved, and that was, you know, the stars, even though some of them close by, and it didn't take them long to get to us. Others, you know, millions of light years away. Some aren't even existing today, but the light is still mm-hmm. traveling. They all mm-hmm. showed up at one time, right? In this moment, this present moment, for him. Mm-hmm. And this is the way the universe acts too. You know, that no matter how disparate and manifold it is, it comes to us in one time and one place, to us uniquely, because we are the receivers, if you like, of that. So everything that happens is in the now. And I love that idea that he realized that. And then in that moment, he realized that everything is present. So there's only one of us here, kind of thing. We are one being. I'm not separate from anything. And that's a huge breakthrough, I think, for a lot of us, is the idea that we're not separate from the rest of creation or all the other 7 billion people on this planet. You know, we are actually part and parcel. We are one with everyone. And that's a huge shift in awareness, isn't it?
No, it is. It's one of those things that when you're aware of it, when you see it, it's you can't turn away from it. You know, you can say that all of us have it in different ways. For me, you know, it was a question, and like we tend to be afraid of what happens after our last breath. You know, we're consumed with what happens after death, but we forget to ask ourselves, well, when did life start? You know, when I was growing up, you know, when I was a child, I used to think that life began when I was born, when I came out of my mother, my birth date. Then as I became educated, I began to believe it was the moment of my conception. But then as time progressed, there was a question that came. It's like, when did life start? And life was already in the sperm. Life was already in the ovum. Life was already there. Life didn't start at my conception. Life was already there. So you can say life, me, the energy that animates this body, that animates this mind, was already there in my father and my mother. And then you can say, well, my life didn't start with my mother, my father. It started before that. And then the imagination begins to expand. That's the tree of life. You see that life went far beyond my ancestors to a common point. And you can say that common point is realizing that we are all one, because we all have a common ancestor. We all come from that one single point, and not just humans, but every single living being. So you can say that when you look at the stars up in the sky, you can say that all those stars that we can see that are light years away all came from a single point. They just happen to go further and further out. You know, it's like Neil deGrasse Tyson said, if you shift your point of view from a different solar system or a different galaxy, all the stars look like they're still going from a different direction, like the source comes from that one point, but we're all going and expanding in our own direction, but it all comes from that one single point, from that single point of origin. So the only thing that truly separates us is a single point of view, but we are all one, because the energy that animates this body, that gives life to this body, is the same energy that animates my father and my mother and my grandparents when they were around. Life is the most beautiful expression that it is, and it only exists in this present moment, because that's the only thing we get to see.
And I love this, because it's much more grounded than saying, you know, in a sort of a Pollyanna, New Agey way, you know, we're all one, you know, and we're all, you know, kind of quasi-spiritual. This is actually a scientific fact, isn't it? It's the idea that you don't have to be go off into extreme, you know, spiritual realms just to look and listen and see how the way the universe works. In other words, you don't need religion to understand this. It penetrates every single thing and every single person, regardless of what we may believe about things.
Yeah, exactly. And the thing about it is that we all put it in a language that allows us to understand. You know, we can use the language of science as we can use the language of yoga or spirituality or religion or myth. You know, we can describe words. For example, I love to use the expression of the story, for example. Say, let's use yoga, for example. We have a moment of clarity. You know, yoga is being at one with breath. So when you first start going to yoga, the very first lessons, well, we're cranking our neck, looking at what the teacher's doing, right? We're in that position. We're in downward dog, looking up at the teacher, trying to see. So our mind is not really what we're doing. We're seeing what everyone else is around us doing. But with practice, little by little, we stop turning our heads towards the teacher and start looking down, as we are able to recognize the words that are associated with the movement. And all of a sudden, we're just listening as opposed to looking up. We're listening, and our body is flowing. Then, after some practice, little by little, we actually start breathing with the movements that the teacher is actually telling us to breathe with. All of a sudden, we breathe, going downward dog, going breathe into into that flat position and upward dog and all that kind of things. And then little by little, the mind slowly moves away from the actual movements and names, and we start moving with our breath. And the breath, for some reason, we begin to be in synchronicity with the rest of the group. And all of a sudden, one day after some years of practice, all of a sudden we have a moment of clarity. All of a sudden we have this moment of communion that is yoga, that is breath, being at one with the body, that all of a sudden with the movements of the breath, we experience an experience of divinity or communion. And we have this aha moment of, wow, I am one with everything. Just like my father describes, I'm one with the stars. I'm one with everything, and it's through the breath. And then when you finish the class, because we learn it through yoga, we're going to use the language of yoga, because that's the environment we have. That's the experience. But when we have the experience, we have the language that allows us to share with one another. You know, for example, I love the word actions speak louder than words. But here's the thing. We use words to describe every action. So we have a moment of clarity. We have an aha moment, whether it be in the yoga studio or in South Asia or in India or in Africa or in Europe or in Russia or in China and Japan, in South America or the desert or the United States or North America. We use the language that our community creates. And in that language, it begins to sound different because we use it in our own language, but we're all experiencing a communion, and we use the language that we know. So you can say that we can find that aha moment, not just in religion or spirituality or in myth, but we definitely find it in science. And in science, we can say that we create languages, we create expressions to describe what we're seeing. And what we're seeing is life. So from that point of view, you can say that to see that we're all one, all we have to do is take a breath. But you can also ask yourself, when did life start? Life was already in the sperm. Life was already in the ovum. And all of a sudden, your imagination just flows to look at how life is in everything and every single ancestor that's been around. That I, life, have been around for beyond my imagination. But this human being, this body, has been around since the moment of conception, you can say. But life, the energy that animates it, has been around for a long time. Now, I use the images of science from that point of view, but we can say that our ancestors used the image of a deity going up to Olympus and taking the fire from the gods and sharing it with humanity. All of a sudden, even that image describes it. So we're all having a beautiful experience. We are all having the engagement of life, and we all have the language that allows us to share that image with one another so you and I can understand each other. And that, to me, is the beautiful thing. The only thing that separates us is a point of view, and hopefully we have the right language by which we can understand each other. And there
right.
is.
Exactly. Let me read a passage here. It's from page 57 of the book, because I think this is a good way to end our first segment and really talks to and speaks to what you just said. It says, when we are born, we are completely free, because you are just you. As you grow up, you are still you, but the difference is that slowly you stop believing that you are you. You create an image in your mind of what you should be, and you believe that you are that image. You practice for a long time until that image becomes who you think you are. But of course, it's not you. This image isn't free, because it always has to keep those opinions and judgments happy. The real you is behind all these images. And the real you is always free. Your image isn't real. And only the real you can be free. Drop the image and become free. So it's a beautiful, very clear way of presenting that, isn't it? It's the idea that your authentic self is always with you. You know, it's who you are. But unfortunately, we through domestication, as Don Miguel calls it, you know, through conditioning, we buy into images that aren't necessarily the truth. And so, as we said last week with Don Jose, you know, the important thing is not to learn anymore. It's to unlearn, to get back to that authentic, natural state that is our divine birthright.
Yeah, you can say that part of our domestication into our society is that society, or what we call the dream of the planet, only has one condition. I need to know who you are in order for me to understand you. You can say that's where our identity comes in.
Right.
But with that, we begin to see ourselves not as an individual, but we see ourselves as a definition, a symbol with a definition, our identity. If we don't have a definition or an identity to go with it, we feel lost, you know, because society doesn't know it. But who we are, what we are, in order for us to know who we are, is just the experience of being alive, to see ourselves without that definition. You know, our body may have a shape, but the energy that animates it, just like our mind, doesn't really have a shape. It changes, it morphs with every new experience. It engages with every new experience. So who we are, what we are, is that, you can say that it's the energy that gives life to this body, that gives life to this mind, but what we are has no definition. We just are. We are this living being that no symbol can truly ever encompass. All we can really know about ourselves is the experience of being us. And you can say to me, that's what liberation is, to let go of the chain of trying to live up to an image that doesn't exist and enjoy being who I am right now, the sum of every choice that I've ever made, and at the same time, the youngest I will ever be.
Yes. And to, you know, to throw ourselves into the mystery of it. I think there's another passage where your father talks about, you know, everything is the unknown. We don't know everything, but we're in this safe universe where that's okay. And to be part of this mysterious unfoldment is perfectly fine, right? It's when we want to control it and make it happen a certain way that we miss the beauty of life, that we're no longer free to explore and play. When you're a child, you don't worry about knowing everything. Everything's an adventure, you know, it's joyous. But we learn to be serious and try and control our environment, and it leads to all kinds of craziness. And we're at the break. When we come back, I'm going to talk more with the wonderful Don Miguel Ruiz Jr., continuing the legacy of his father. And we'll talk about his apprenticeship and some of the experiences that he's had in his life thus far. Join us after these messages from Unity.
To share the programs that inspire you most with audiences around the world? That's easier than ever with mobile giving. Just text Unity Radio to 72727 and help us continue offering spiritual programs that change lives.
Kintsugi is an ancient Japanese art form of fusing broken pottery pieces together by filling the cracks with gold. The resulting piece is not only restored and visually stunning, it also takes on a new life. Whatever has happened in the past, however broken we may feel, we can be whole again by filling our lives with the transformative power of God. Our experiences make us unique. The presence of God makes us whole. As Paul wrote in his letter to the Romans, be transformed by the renewing of your minds, so that you may discern what is the will of God, what is good and acceptable and perfect. Remember, with God, all things are possible.
This Mindful Moment is brought to you by Daily Word Magazine. Finding time for the positive reminders in Daily Word is easy with the digital edition, perfect for smartphones and readers on the go. Take advantage of our 30-day free trial to the online magazine, plus a daily email with the word for the day and the Daily Word app. To sign up for a free 30-day trial, visit unityonlineradio.org/dailyword. Been listening to World Spirituality with host Reverend Paul John Roach. To learn more about Reverend Paul John Roach, visit his website, pauljohnroach.com. Or if you have questions, email him at pauljohnroach@yahoo.com. We now return to World Spirituality.
All right, welcome back to today's show. Yeah, check out my my website and look up my recent podcast on Taoism, Taoism 101. I think you'll find that quite interesting. I'm with Don Miguel Ruiz Jr., and we're talking about his latest book, The Little Book of Wisdom, The Essential Teachings of His Father, Don Miguel Ruiz. And in part three, there's wonderful stories about some of the learning experiences that you went through, Don Miguel. One of them about the Room of Mirrors really struck me because I'm writing a book on the spiritual path in 12 rock songs. And one of the rock songs is George Harrison's The Rising Sun. And in that song, one of the lyrics is, in a room of mirrors, you can see for miles, but everything that's there is in disguise. And I thought when I read your piece about the room, I thought, oh yeah, this is identical here. This is wonderful. But it's not just in disguise, is it? It's illusory, but we get to see our reality. Talk about that, because your dad had built this room, small room, like a meditation room, with mirrors on each of the walls, right? And so you were able to see your image reflected, you know, multiple times, and you
for miles and miles,
like for miles and miles, yeah, that's
for
right.
miles to miles,
yeah.
It's based on my father and my grandmother taught a lot with mirrors. You know, when we were, for example, when we were young, my grandmother used to have us cousins play with it, unbeknownst to us that she was getting us ready for these kind of ceremonies. But the game she would have us do is first look into your eyes and try not to blink. You know, that's the thing, you know. And then little by little, it's like she put a flame in front of us, and we look into the eyes. And, you know, us kids, you know, we started telling scary stories around it, you know, because our faces tended always to go dark. You know, all of a sudden we look into our eyes, and all of a sudden it just goes dark. You know, and usually when we were kids, it just at that point we're just like, what? What is that? So me and my cousins used to play that with my grandma, and you know, like my grandma says, learn to keep your attention, because as soon as you have a thought, all of that you see will go away. So learn to see without thinking, without trying to narrate what you see. Just see it. Just learn to do that. So it took us a long time, you know, as a game, as a play that we did as kids. And my father, during that time, of course, he was starting to work with mirror rooms quite a bit in his meditation and an apprenticeship with my grandmother. You can say that she had taken him to a different direction. So when I was 14, you know, I had already started my apprenticeship with my grandmother. So my father took me into his mirror room. You know, out in the backyard, he made a little structure of a building that all the walls were covered in mirrors, you know, a carpet in the floor and a white ceiling on top. So my dad would put a candle in front of me. We sat both cross-legged in pretzel position, and with our backs to one another. So basically our back was supporting the other's back. And of course, once right away, the old game that my grandma used to play was right there. You know, I've been practicing forever. And then my father said, keep your eyes focused on your eyes.
don't get hooked by all the use around you. Don't get hooked by looking at how you look from behind. This, don't even look at my own. Just look. All I want you to see is your own reflection that's standing right in front of you. That's it. Don't get hooked by anything else but that. Then, you know, the same thing as my grandmother, don't let a thought distract you. So it's about strengthening the will, strengthening the will of your attention, how long you can focus your attention on one thing. So you can say that little by little, you know, the face would go dark. And then, after some time, the face went dark, and then a face reappeared, but then it looked different. It looked like a woman. Then it changed to a boy. Then it changed to a man of a different ethnicity in mine, and then again and again and again, and it went black, and then it went up again, and I'm like, what is that? And when I referred to that point of, sorry, someone's trying to get a hold of me, but when I focused my attention on those things, my father looked at me and says, what you're seeing is your own projection. The mind is projecting on to you what it always sees, the mask of life, the projection mm-hmm. of life. But I kept telling my father, but I saw this face, I saw that face. And my mind was quickly trying to create a story about it. Who are these people? What are these people? Who did I see? Past lives? All the temptation that it was to see that. And my father just kept saying, you are seeing what the mind always wants to do, which is to project. When it doesn't like seeing what it doesn't know, so it projects what it does know. It's a projection. It's something that the mind does. It's an illusion. What he was trying to teach me there is not necessarily that I have the capacity to have that, but to become aware how I'm able to create a projection of myself, how I project myself from moment to moment, from the projection of a student to the projection of a boyfriend, to the projection of a college student, to a worker, to a doctor, to an author, to a lecturer. And all of a sudden, how I see myself it changes just as rapidly as the images that I'm seeing in the mirror. So you can say that was exactly the essence of that lesson of that particular day. And since then, it's all been a practice of awareness of how my mind creates thus projection. And when I'm aware of one that's making me unhappy, to change it. You can say when you don't like the story you create, change the story, change the main character, my dad would always say. And that's exactly what he refers to. The character is the projection of me in life. And it's illusion.
Oh. Go ahead.
No, sorry. That was it. That was
no,
the final.
Please, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, no worries. No, it's just that the image of myself that I have is just an illusion. But who I am, what I am, you know, I'm always changing. I'm always morphing, which means I have no form. But I have a form according to the point of view of the people who know me, the mask that people project onto me. If I believe them, then I let someone else dictate my own story. But if I'm aware that I'm the author of my own story, then I can create the most beautiful, harmonious dream or the most perfect nightmare. It's my choice.
Right, yes. And of course, it's okay to have these various roles, isn't it? They exist to a degree. You know, we are fathers or sons. We are, you know, teachers mm-hmm. or whatever we might be. But once we see ourselves that rigidly cannot escape from those roles, there's a problem, I think. And so yeah. we can flow between all these various things that we take on in our lives, right?
Yes, exactly, because when we can become rigid of this is who I am and I'm trying to convey that to everyone, then I'm no longer really living, because the image of a Nawal in the old stories is of a shapeshifter. You know, the old stories of the shapeshifting Nawal that turns into an animal, well, they're all it's an analogy to someone who has no form. And when I realize when I have no form is realizing that every relationship I am in brings out different elements of me. For example, if I use the example of the three women in my life, my mom, my wife, and my daughter, I'm the constant between the three. But who I am and how I behave with the three of them is different because the relationships are different. In my mother's eyes, I am the son, and what she brings out of me is a whole history of 41 years of a relationship of someone I love very much who has been nurturing me. The way my wife has been seeing me for 13 years is dramatically different. Yet it's the same love, but my behavior, my actions, my engagement of her, she brings out a totally different element than my mother does. And my daughter brings out a totally different element than my mom and my wife combined couldn't. So all three of them bring out a different element of me because the relationship is different. But I'm the constant in all three. So right. Who I am, well, I am all three. But if I define myself by all three, then if I put on the mask with every woman I know, then it's no longer a true because that person, that friend, is going to bring out a totally different element of me. I have my friends who are girls or women, and they will bring a totally different element of me. Now, the difference between my mom, my wife, and my daughter is that the level of intimacy is in love is expressed differently. And out of the 7.5 billion people in the world, these three women bring out those elements of me. And if I add the men in my life, my son, my brothers, my father, then it changes again. I am the constant, yet in being the constant, every single person in my life will see me differently. And once again, I'm in the mirror room. Every person sees me dramatically different, and my temptation is to believe every single one of them as truth, and that's where domestication comes in. I can domesticate myself and try to live up to those images, or I just simply am aware of the truth, that that's how they see me, and that's the element that they'll see of myself, and if they see me change, well, that's up to them. You know, because, for example, I can have an ex-girlfriend of mine, and an ex-girlfriend will see that guy she dated a long time ago, and to her eyes, I may still be that tyrant, or she'll give me the benefit of the doubt and see the change. And see that I'm no longer that young man that I was in my 20s when I dated her. And that only comes with the willingness of her seeing it. But what matters is not that she sees me, it's whether or not I see that change.
Yes.
And that's what matters most, that I'm aware of my own evolution.
And the evolution, of course, is to discover one's authentic self so that, you know, we're not then fooled by all the various roles we have to play, you know, because I think when we don't have a center within in our own being of who we are in truth, you know, we can be influenced, you know, by the various company we keep, right? So that not only do they see us in a certain way, but we become that when we're with that person. And when you are centered in your authentic self, you you morph a little bit because you're different with different people, but you still remember the heart of you, if you like, the core, and that remains constant no matter, you know, what you're expected to do. I think, you know, when I was younger, I could be intimidated in certain groups of people, you know, especially people I didn't know or whatever, they especially if they were authority figures and everything. But yeah. But now I can go pretty much anywhere I want, you know, and I'm calm and centered. I'm not intimidated. I think because I've discovered who I am and the fact that who I am is the same as everybody else. So I'm not intimidated by other people's appearance or role or whether they have power or not. So, you know, it's a sense of being at ease in your own skin, if you like.
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly the same experience. You and I have definitely had the experience when I was young, exactly the same way. And people of authority, or in my case, I would say the people who I wanted to be validated by.
Yeah.
I gave away my power. I gave away my power. You can say that there's the expression that Eleanor Roosevelt has that I absolutely love, which is no one can make me feel inferior without my consent. I love that expression. Which means that all the times I was intimidated are people who I immediately valued their opinion about who I am more than I valued my own. So you can say that I was constantly trying to live up to an image that didn't exist based on someone else's projection.
Yes.
So you can see right then and there that was where my insecurities came, and I kept looking for that definition that brought acceptance or in my generation's that being cool, man. But
yeah,
little by little, who I am, what I am, what made me feel comfortable in the way you're describing yourself, I find it to be being me. Being me has no definition. Being me has nothing that binds it. It's me. Being me is just being alive. This is who I am right now, and I'm going to change in a week, and I'm not the same man I was a week ago, and I'm definitely not the same guy I was when I was 28. Every experience of life, every new agreement changes who I am. And
yeah,
that's what living is. You know, if we're stuck with one image and force ourselves to be that image, then we're no longer allowing life to impact us. And going back to something we were saying before the break, I think the difference between an adult and a child, you know, a child, or to be childlike is to be in awe of the world, to let the world continue to surprise you. But as we get attached to our beliefs and want to be safe in our own definitions, then our perception narrows, holding on to definitions that makes us feel safe, it makes us feel secure or empowered, because we don't want to let go of what we know, because the unknown, well, can be scary.
Absolutely.
But if we open our perception again and be in awe of the world, then we lose that fear again. We lose the fear of the world by letting the world surprise us again like we were when we were children. And the difference is that when we're children, we're willing to learn. We want to learn. And then somewhere along the line, if we get it wrong or we don't know, then we get the punishment and we reject ourselves. And that's why we hold on to what we don't know, what we know. So because it makes us feel safe, it makes us feel secure.
Yes, but there's a great passage on 95 that talks about this too. I'd like to read it. It says the penalties of domestication dissolve when you don't take things personally, don't make assumptions, always do your best, and are impeccable in your word. There's the four agreements. You realize that whatever people say is only their point of view and only true for them. And here's the last couple of lines that I really like. It says, the result is that you are free. My freedom is the most important thing to me, and I won't give it away by judging myself or others. Wow. That just those two sentences are extremely powerful, I think. My freedom is the most important thing to me, right? And I won't give it away by judging myself or others. Wow. You know, because unfortunately, we spend a lot of time judging both ourselves and others, you know, and sifting and comparing and this, that, and the other. And if we just gave that up and allowed ourselves just to be authentically free and authentically ourselves, you know, then that freedom is the most precious gift we can ever have. And I love that. My freedom is most important thing to me. I'm not going to just give it away, right? And I think what great advice that is, isn't it, to live a sparkling life, you know, free of encumbrance.
Yeah, exactly. It's for me, not taking things personal, the way I've come to learn it, is I'm only responsible to the tips of my own fingers. I am responsible for my yes and my no and the consequences of my choices. But I'm not responsible for the will of another person, nor am I responsible for the perception of another. So to not take things personal to me simply means not assume responsibility for anyone else's will, but take complete responsibility for my own. And that to me is personal freedom. That's the ability to be free. That's the freedom that to me that expression means, that when I no longer take other people's when I stop being responsible for someone else's actions or what they say. You know, someone can say, walk down the street and says, "Hey, Miguel, you're stupid." And if I believe it, I'm going to say, "How does he know? I must be showing it." Basically, allowing that word to impact me, I'm giving it permission to impact me by assuming responsibility of what they said. But I don't control how they see the world. I don't control their actions. I don't control how they see it. I only control my own. And with that, there's a certain liberation, because that means that in my own perception, I can give power to words that are going to impact me or not. And also, I let other people experience life in their own way. To not assume responsibility for their actions is to respect someone for their own yeses and their own noes, and they're perfectly capable of experiencing their own consequences. I don't have to pay for them.
Yes. There was a great story in the book about how you were taught by your dad these very things in a restaurant, because, you know, you were going to dinner one time and he goes and changes into his pajamas and slippers or whatever to go to dinner. And of course, yeah, you try to act like everything's cool, you know, so you weren't being authentic about your feelings, because your real feelings were very, you were upset with that he was being this stupid. But he kept pushing it, didn't he? He kept acting goofy, etc. You were projecting so much on him, you know, well, how dare you do this? But he didn't vocalize it. So he is a wonderful story about you taking personal responsibility for you and not for him, right? That took some chutzpah on his part, though, but to go to dinner, you know, dressed like that, you know, he's willing to make himself look like a fool in order to demonstrate something, and that takes a certain humility, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, it's the thing. I mean, I remember that night perfectly well. We were up in Rochester, New York, doing a presentation, and the people who brought us over put us up in a very nice hotel with a very nice restaurant. So when we came back from the event, and my father saw that there was a restaurant, oh, he said, hey, let's go grab a bite to eat. And I looked, and everyone was dressed nice, people in suit and ties, and the ladies all dressed nice. And I said, hey, Pop, let's go upstairs and freshen up. Because even though we were in our presentation clothes, after presentation, you know, you start looking not so good. So let's go upstairs and freshen up. And my father just gives me that look and says, okay. So we went upstairs. I went to my room, got clean. He went to his room, he got cleaned up. I went downstairs looking smart and all that, looking good. And then my dad walks out of the elevator and he's in his pajamas and slippers. I'm like, oh no. My dad wants to teach me a lesson. Don't bite, don't bite, don't bite, don't bite. I'm saying it like a mantra. Don't bite, don't bite, don't give in to it. My father walks up to me and says, Miguel, is there anything wrong? And I said, nope, nope, nothing wrong. Are you sure? I'm like, yep. So, okay. So he starts walking towards the restaurant, and I'm walking behind him like a teenager, once again embarrassed by his father, who's embarrassing him, obviously. And then there's no dress code. Like, the restaurant has no dress code, so there's no sign. People are dressed nice because they want to dress nice, because it's a nice hotel, a nice restaurant, and all that. So when the hostess comes up and says, table for three, she has no problem with it. My dad says, yes. So we follow the hostess, and she walks us straight down the middle of the restaurant. And since I'm walking behind him, I can see all the heads turning to the left or right, looking towards him. And I can begin to hear the little murmurs here and there. And I'm so self-conscious. I'm very embarrassed by this whole thing. But I'm trying my best not to show it, you know. But I'm trying to play it off as cool, whatever. And my dad once again tells me, is there anything wrong? And I said, nope. Nope. So he sits down, he looks for glasses, but he doesn't have it. Someone who's with us lends him hers. He puts it on. There's a different prescription, and his eyes bug out, and my poker face gives away, and I go, oh, no. So my father pounces because he saw that I was embarrassed, and he says, Miguel, what's wrong? I said, Pop, come on. This is a nice restaurant. People are dressed nice. Here you are. Dressing in your pajamas, people will think you're like Howard Hughes or something, like an eccentric. Pop, it's embarrassing. And my dad looks at me and says, with a straight face, do you disrespect me so much that you think you have to pay for my own actions, that you have to pay my own consequences with your own embarrassment? Mm-hmm. Do you disrespect me that much that you don't think I can pay for my own consequences? And that's when I became aware of the truth, that I do take things personal. You know, so when I became aware that, you know, part of my domestication was, you know, things like birds of a feather fly together, or I'll tell you who you are by who you hang out with, that embarrassment of, like, see that boy over there? Like, aren't you embarrassed? That embarrassment was something, a catalyst in me that made me want to domesticate other people. But it's also what made me assume responsibility for someone else's actions, that somehow I'm letting someone else's actions speak for me. And because I think, well, you're next to me, and if you're next to me, you're representing me, so you better behave because you'll make me look bad.
Yes.
That's how I assume responsibility for someone else's actions. You can say it's the moment of clarity of becoming aware of how I take things personal and accept the truth that I took things personally. And I looked at my dad and says, Dad, you're right, I'm sorry, I am. And my dad looks at me and says, okay, fine, let's go eat. So he just wanted to go eat, but it's the moment where I became aware that I wasn't what I wanted to. I was pretending to be something I wasn't. You know,
right.
That image of Don Miguel Ruiz Jr. doesn't exist. So like an alcoholic or drug addict, hello, my name is Miguel Ruiz Jr. I take things personally. I make assumptions. Sometimes I'm not impeccable with my word, and sometimes I don't do my best. Just ask my wife. She's my witness.
There we go.
And that, in a way, that's the way we use it. So a moment of clarity without any action is just a thought that passes in the wind. But a moment of clarity followed by action becomes a pivotal moment in my life. And that's how my father taught me the truth, that I take things personal and I saw it clearly. And you can say that's when I began to practice that agreement in a different way.
Yes. Beautiful, beautiful story. I want to close the show by reading and have you comment on another passage. It's on page 191. It's one of my favorites in the whole book. And it talks about Jesus a little bit. It says, when you stop judging everyone and everything around you, including your parents, your teachers, your government, and God, then you have reached what we call the last judgment. This means it's the last time that you judge yourself. When that happens, the war inside you is over. It is the end of your story and the beginning of a new world order, a world of peace and joy within you. This is the world of the Master. If you remember the biblical story of Jesus in the desert, where for 40 days he faces all the temptations from Satan, you can see that Satan is Jesus's knowledge. On the final day, he stopped judging himself, and with the last judgment, there is no more Satan. Jesus becomes the Christ, which means he becomes the Master. He starts sharing whatever he knows with whoever wants to listen to him. Isn't that a beautiful explanation of both the 40 days in the wilderness, but also the fact that, you know, we are our own worst enemy, but we're also the one that frees us. So Satan was useful in a way because Satan brought Jesus to a full understanding. And all the things that have happened to us in our lives, you know, we can laugh at it now because everything has brought us to that moment. So, you know, that story of the restaurant is humorous because, you know, it points to the fact we all make mistakes. Don't take it so seriously, right? This is a joy. We're meant to live in joy.
Mm-hmm. And be willing to learn from life. You see, for me, that's the moment where we stop loving ourselves conditionally and begin to love ourselves unconditionally. You know, you could say that the opposite of love is not hate or anger. Anger are just the instruments we use to implement the opposite of love, which is love, the corruption of love, the distortion of love. So you can say that the opposite of unconditional love is conditional love, which is simply the corruption of the word, you can say. So you can say that the last judgment is the moment we forgive ourselves forever loving ourselves conditionally and forever giving power to a belief that says, I am not worthy of my own love. That I am worthy because I'm alive.
What I love about that, too, is that, you know, we're not in the more traditional Christian terminology. We're supposed to be in trepidation of the last judgment, you know. Whereas in this metaphysical way of looking at things, this more expansive way of looking at things, the last judgment is our ultimate freedom. So it's nothing to be afraid of, you know. It's the annihilation of our false self, of Satan, if you like. It's certainly not anything to be fearful of because God loves us unconditionally, right? The universe supports us unconditionally, and so when we can cooperate with that, make an agreement with that, then we become unconditionally loving beings ourselves. And so it's not condemnation. It's freedom. It's release. It's triumph.
It's the redemption of love. It's the redemption of the mind. The redemption of the corrupted word once again is with God.
Folks, we're at the end of the show. Let me tell you about next week, and then we'll say goodbye to Don Miguel Ruiz Jr. Next week, Lisa Smart joins me. She's going to talk about words on the threshold, what our last words reveal about our life, death, and the afterlife. So that should be interesting. But right now, I want to thank so much Don Miguel Ruiz Jr. for being with me. What a wonderful show. Thank you for your life work and all that you're bringing to the world.
Thank you so much, Reverend, for the opportunity to be with you on this show and for the opportunity to share. So thank you. It was wonderful.
All right. Thank glad you could be with us. All right. Thanks for listening. And join us again next week. Bye-bye now.
Thank you for tuning in to World Spirituality with Reverend Paul John Roach. Join us every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Central to further examine the spiritual teachings and religious traditions of our world and to discover the universal truth principles present in all. World Spirituality, only on UnityOnlineRadio.org, the voice of an awakening world. This program is brought to you in part by Unity Church of Fort Worth in Fort Worth, Texas, celebrating the Christ Spirit in all people. Online at www.unityfortworth.org.
Experience the peace and joy promised by A Course in Miracles? Or are you still struggling to truly live your beliefs from moment to moment? Let Reverend Jennifer Hadley help you focus on your intent to be the love, be the peace, through practical application by walking your talk. Experience the healing live every Tuesday at 10 a.m. Central on A Course in Miracles, living the love, walking the talk, only on Unity Online Radio, the voice of an awakening world.
Have you ever stood by a railroad track when a fast train was approaching from a distance? As the train came nearer, the roar of the engine and the screech of the whistle seemed to rise in pitch and become louder. As it came alongside, it seemed larger than life and ready to engulf you. Then as the train passed by, the sound became lower in pitch and loudness until at last it was merely an echo in the distance. Just like that train, sometimes our experiences appear larger than life just before they pass us by. It seems they are going to engulf us, and then suddenly, they're gone. Perhaps you are in a larger-than-life situation right now. Changing your thoughts can result in positive changes in you and the world around you.
This message has been brought to you by the Association of Unity Churches International. To find a Unity Church near you, visit www.unity.org.
Ever notice that there might be something not quite right, but you just can't put your finger on it? We may describe it as an inner stirring, a restlessness, a yearning to find our way home to our heart and higher purpose. Some of us may feel like we are living on borrowed time, that despite our accomplishments, what was once so important to us now just feels empty and meaningless. If you find your heart longing, wanting, looking for a path home to authenticity and purpose, join us for transformation, inspiration, hope, and possibility. Move toward your higher calling. Listen to The Call of Spirit with Evelyn Foreman and tune in to Possibility every Wednesday at 3 p.m. Central Time here on Unity Online Radio.
sometimes you feel so alone and overwhelmed, you don't know where to turn. These days, it seems like there is no end to our problems. We invite you to connect with Silent Unity, the 24-hour prayer ministry where someone is waiting to pray with you right now. Since 1890, Silent Unity has always been there. No judgment or dogma, just someone affirming the best for you. Call 816-969-2000 today. You can also connect online at unityprayervigil.org.